What? Beset by illusionary sand dunes and the ghosts of ancient kings, and also by the knowledge that the name of the faith upon which the city stood meant submission, my new fellow citizens exuded the flat, boiled odours of acquiescence, which were depressing to a nose which had smelt at the very last, and however briefly, the highly spiced nonconformity of Bombay. Soon after our arrival, and perhaps oppressed by the musk-shadowed air of the Clayton Roadhouse, my father resolved to build us a new home. He bought a plot of land in the smartest of the societies, the new housing development zones, and on my 16th birthday, Salim acquired more than a Lambretta. I learned the occult powers of umbilical cords. What, pickled in brine, sat for 16 years in my father's Almira, awaiting such a day? What, floating like a water snake in an old pickle jar, accompanied us on our sea journey and ended up buried in hard, barren Karachi earth? What had once nourished life in a womb? What now infused earth with miraculous life and gave birth to a split-level American-style modern bungalow? Eschewing these cryptic questions, I explain that on my 16th birthday, my family, including Alia Auntie, assembled on our plot of Karanji Road earth, watched by the eyes of a team of labourers and the beard of a mullah, Ahmed handed Salim a pickaxe. I drove it inaugurally into the ground. A new beginning, Amina said. Inshallah, we shall all be new people now. Spurred on by her noble and unattainable desire, a workman rapidly enlarged my hole, and now a pickle jar was produced. Brine was discarded on the thirsty ground, and what was left inside received the mullah's blessings. After which an umbilical cord, was it mine or Shiva's, was implanted in the earth, and at once a house began to grow. There were sweetmeats and soft drinks. The mullah, displaying remarkable hunger, consumed 39 laddus, and Amit Sanai did not once complain of the expense. The spirit of the buried cord inspired the workmen, but although the foundations were dug very deep, they would not prevent the house from falling down before we ever lived in it. What I surmised about umbilical cords. Although they possessed the power of growing houses, some were evidently better at the job than others. The city of Karachi proved my point. Clearly constructed on top of entirely unsuitable cords, it was full of deformed houses, the stunted hunchback children of deficient lifelines, houses growing mysteriously blind with no visible windows, houses which looked like radios or air conditioners or jail cells, crazy top-heavy edifices which fell over with monotonous regularity like drunks. A wild proliferation of mad houses, whose inadequacies as living quarters were exceeded only by their quite exceptional ugliness. The city obscured the desert, but either the cords or the infertility of the soil made it grow into something grotesque. Capable of smelling sadness and joy, of sniffing out intelligence and stupidity with my eyes closed, I arrived at Karachi and adolescence, understanding, of course, that the subcontinent's new nations and I had all left childhood behind, that growing pains and strange, awkward alterations of voice were in store for us all. Drainage censored my inner life. My sense of connection remained undrained. Salim invaded Pakistan armed only with a hypersensitive nose, but, worst of all, he invaded from the wrong direction. All successful conquests of that part of the world have begun in the north. All conquerors have come by land. Sailing ignorantly against the winds of history, I reached Karachi from the southeast and by sea. What followed should not, I suppose, have surprised me. With hindsight, the advantages of sweeping down from the north are self-evident. From the north came the Umayyad generals, Hajjaj bin Yusuf and Muhammad bin Qasim, also the Ismailis. Honeymoon Lodge, where it is said Ali Khan sojourned with Rita Hayworth, overlooked our plot of umbilicized earth. Rumour has it that the film star created much scandal by wandering in the grounds dressed in a series of fabulous, gauzy Hollywood negligees. Oh, ineluctable superiority of northernness! From which direction did Mahmud of Ghazni descend upon these Indus plains, bringing with him a language boasting no fewer than three forms of the letter S? The inescapable answer, Se, Sin, and Swad were northern intruders, and Muhammad bin Samghuri, who overthrew the Ghaznavids and established the Delhi Caliphate. Samghuri's son too moved southwards on his progress. And Tughlaq and the Mughal emperors. But I've made my point. It remains only to add that ideas as well as armies swept south. South, south from the northern heights. The legend of Sikandar, Butt Sikan, the iconoclast of Kashmir, who, at the end of the 14th century, destroyed every Hindu temple in the valley, establishing a precedent for my grandfather, travelled down from the hills to the river plains. And 500 years later, the Mujahideen movement of Syed Ahmed Berwali followed the well-trodden trail. Berwali's ideas, self-denial, hatred of Hindus, holy war, philosophies as well as kings, to cut this short, came from the opposite direction to me. Salim's parents said, "We must all become new people." In the land of the pure, purity became our ideal. But Salim was forever tainted with Bombayness. His head was full of all sorts of religions apart from Allah's. Like India's first Muslims, the mercantile Moplas of Malabar, I had lived in a country whose population of deities rivaled the numbers of its people, so that, in unconscious revolt against the claustrophobic throng of deities, my family had espoused the ethics of business, not faith. And his body was to show a marked preference for the impure. Mopla-like, I was doomed to be a misfit. But, in the end, purity found me out, and even I, Salim, was cleansed of my misdeeds. After my 16th birthday, I studied history at my Aunt Alia's college, but not even learning could make me feel a part of this country, devoid of midnight children, in which my fellow students took out processions to demand a stricter, more Islamic society, proving that they had contrived to become the antithesis of students everywhere else on earth by demanding more rules, not less. My parents, however, were determined to put down roots. Although Ayub Khan and Bhutto were forging an alliance with China, which had so recently been our enemy, Ahmed and Amina would listen to no criticisms of their new home, and my father bought a towel factory. There was a new brilliance about my parents in those days. Amina had lost her guilt fog. Her verrucas seemed not to be playing up anymore, while Ahmed, although still whitened, had felt the freeze of his loins thawing under the heat of his newfound love for his wife. On some mornings, Amina had tooth marks on her neck. She giggled uncontrollably at times like a schoolgirl. "You too, honestly," her sister Alia said, "like honeymooners or I don't know what." But I could smell what was hidden behind Alia's teeth, what stayed inside when the friendly words came out. Ahmed Sinai named his towels after his wife, Amina brand. Who are these multi-multis, these Dawoods, Segals, Haroons? He cried gaily, dismissing the richest families in the land. Who are Valikas or Zulfikars? I could eat them 10 at a time, you wait, he promised. In 2 years the whole world would be wiping itself on an Amina brand cloth. The finest dairy cloth. The most modern machines, we shall make the whole world clean and dry. Daywoods and Zulfikars will beg to know my secret, and I will say yes, the towels are high quality. But the secret is not in the manufacturing. It was love that conquered all. I discerned in my father's speech the lingering effects of the optimism virus. Did Amina Brand conquer the world in the name of cleanliness, which is next to... did Valikas and Segals come to ask Amitsunai, "God, we're stumped, ya! How do you do it?" Did high-quality terry cloth in patterns devised by Ahmed himself, a little gaudy, but never mind, they were born of love, wipe away the moistness of Pakistanis and export markets alike? Did Russians, Englishmen, Americans wrap themselves in my mother's immortalized name? The story of Amina Brand must wait a while, because the career of Jamila Singha is about to take off. The mosque-shadowed house on Clayton Road has been visited by Uncle Puffs. His real name was Major, retired, Alauddin Latif. He had heard about my sister's voice from,
"My darn good friend General Zulfikar used to be with him in the Border Patrol Force back in 47.
He turned up at Ali Aziz's house shortly after Jamila's 15th birthday, beaming and bouncing, revealing a mouth filled with solid gold teeth.
"I'm a simple fellow," he explained, "like our illustrious president. I keep my cash where it's safe."
Like our illustrious president, the major's head was perfectly spherical. Unlike Ayub Khan, Latif had left the army and entered show business.
"Pakistan's absolute number one impresario, old man," he told my father. "Nothing to it but organization. Old army habit dies darn hard."
Major Latif had a proposition. He wanted to hear Jamila sing.
"And if she's 2% as good as I'm told, my good sir, I'll make her famous. Oh, yes, overnight, certainly. Contacts, that's all it takes. Contacts and organization. And yours truly, Major, retired, Latif has the lot. Alauddin Latif," he stressed, flashing goldly at Amitsunai. "Know the story? I just rub my jolly old lamp, and out pops the genie, bringing fame and fortune. Your girl will be in darn good hands. Darn good."
It is fortunate for Jamila Singer's legion of fans that Amitsunai was a man in love with his wife. Mellowed by his own happiness, he failed to eject Major Latif on the spot. I also believe today that my parents had already come to the conclusion that their daughter's gift was too extraordinary to keep to themselves. The sublime magic of her angel's voice had begun to teach them the inevitable imperatives of talent. But Ahmed and Amina had one concern.
"Our daughter," Ahmed said. He was always the more old-fashioned of the two beneath the surface, "is from a good family. But you want to put her on the stage in front of God knows how many strange men?"
The major looked affronted.
"Sir," he said stiffly, "you think I am not a man of sensibility? Got daughters myself, old man. 7, thank God. Set up a little travel agency business for them. Strictly over the telephone, though. Wouldn't dream of sitting them in an office window. It's the biggest telephonic travel agency in the place, actually. We send train drivers to England, matter of fact, buswalas too. My point," he added hastily, "is that your daughter would be given as much respect as mine. More, actually. She's going to be a star."
Major Latif's daughters, Safia and Rafia, and 5 other Afias, were dubbed, collectively, the Puffias, by the remaining monkey in my sister. Their father was nicknamed first Father Puffia, and then Uncle, a courtesy title, Puffs. He was as good as his word. In 6 months, Jamila Singha was to have hit records, an army of admirers, everything, and all, as I'll explain in a moment, without revealing her face. Uncle Puffs became a fixture in our lives. He visited the Clayton Road house most evenings, at what I used to think of as the cocktail hour, to sip pomegranate juice and asked Jamila to sing a little something. She, who was growing into the sweetest natured of girls, always obliged. Afterwards he would clear his throat as if something had got stuck in it and begin to joke heartily with me about getting married. 24-carat grins blinded me as he,
"Time you took a wife, young man. take my advice. Pick a girl with good brains and bad teeth. You'll have got a friend and a safe deposit box rolled into one.
Uncle Puff's daughters, he claimed, all conformed to the above description. I, embarrassed, smelling out that he was only half-joking, would cry, "Oh, Uncle Puffs!" He knew his nickname, quite liked it even. Slapping my thigh, he cried,
"Playing hard to get, eh? Darn right. Okay, my boy, you pick one of my girls, and I guarantee to have all her teeth pulled out. By the time you marry her, she'll have $1 million pile for a dowry."
Whereupon, my mother usually contrived to change the subject. She wasn't keen on Uncle Puff's idea, no matter how pricey the dentures. On that first night, as so often afterwards, Jamila sang to Major Aluddin Latif. Her voice wafted out through the window and silenced the traffic. The birds stopped chattering, and at the hamburger shop across the street, the radio was switched off. The street was full of stationary people, and my sister's voice washed over them. When she finished, we noticed that Uncle Puffs was crying.
"A jewel," he said, honking into a handkerchief. "Sir and madam, your daughter is a jewel. I am humbled absolutely, darn humbled. She has proved to me that a golden voice is preferable even to golden teeth."
And when Jamila Singer's fame had reached the point at which she could no longer avoid giving a public concert, it was Uncle Puffs who started the rumour that she had been involved in a terrible, disfiguring car crash. It was Major, retired, Latif, who devised her famous all-concealing white silk chadar. The curtain or veil, heavily embroidered in gold brocade work and religious calligraphy, behind which she sat demurely whenever she performed in public. The chadar of Jamila Singer was held up by two tireless muscular figures, also, but more simply, veiled from head to foot. The official story was that they were her female attendants, but their sex was impossible to determine through their burqas. And, at its very centre, the major had cut a hole. Diameter, 3 inches. Circumference, embroidered in finest gold thread. That was how the history of our family once again became the fate of a nation. Because when Jamila sang, with her lips pressed against the brocaded aperture, Pakistan fell in love with a 15-year-old girl whom it only ever glimpsed through a gold and white perforated sheet. The accident rumour set the final seal on her popularity. Her concerts packed out the Bambino Theatre in Karachi and filled the Shalimar Bagh in Lahore. Her records constantly topped the sales charts. And as she became public property, Pakistan's angel, the voice of the nation, the Bulbul-e-Din, or Nightingale of the Faith, and began to receive 1,001 firm proposals of marriage a week, as she became the whole country's favourite daughter and grew into an existence which threatened to overwhelm her place in our own family, so she fell prey to the twin viruses of fame, the first of which made her the victim of her own public image, because the accident rumour obliged her to wear a gold and white burqa at all times, even in my Aunt Alia's school, which she continued to attend. While the second virus subjected her to the exaggerations and simplifications of self, which are the unavoidable side effects of stardom, so that the blind and blinding devoutness and the right or wrong nationalism which had already begun to emerge in her now began to dominate her personality, to the exclusion of almost everything else. Publicity imprisoned her inside a gilded tent, and, being the new daughter of the nation, her character began to owe more to the most strident aspects of the national persona than to the child world of her monkey years. Jamila Singer's voice was on Voice of Pakistan Radio constantly, so that in the villages of West and East Wings she came to seem like a superhuman being, incapable of being fatigued. An angel who sang to her people through all the days and nights, while Amit Sinai, whose few remaining qualms about his daughter's career had been more than allayed by her enormous earnings. Although he had once been a Delhi man, he was now a true Bombay Muslim at heart, placing cash matters above most other things, became fond of telling my sister, "You see, daughter, decency, purity, art, and good business sense can be one and the same things. Your old father has been wise enough to work that out." Jamila smiled sweetly and agreed. She was growing out of scrawny tomboy youth into a slender, slant-eyed, golden-skinned beauty whose hair was nearly long enough to sit on. Even her nose looked good. "In my daughter," Amit Sinai told Uncle Puffs proudly, "it is my side of the family's noble features which have prevailed." Uncle Puffs cast a quizzical, awkward glance at me and cleared his throat.
"Darn fine-looking girl, sir," he told my father. "Top hole, by gum!"
The thunder of applause was never far from my sister's ears. At her first, now legendary, Bambino recital, we sat in seats provided by Uncle Puffs.
"Best darn seats in the house!"
Beside his seven puffiers, all veiled. Uncle Puffs dug me in the ribs.
"Hey, boy, choose. Take your pick. Remember the dowry."
And I blushed and stared hard at the stage. The cries of "Wah! Wah!" were sometimes louder than Jamila's voice. And after the show, we found Jamila backstage drowning in a sea of flowers, so that we had to fight our way through the blossoming camphor garden of the nation's love to find that she was almost fainting, not from fatigue, but from the overpoweringly sweet perfume of adoration with which the blooms had filled the room. I, too, felt my head beginning to swim, until Uncle Puffs began to hurl flowers in great bushels from an open window. They were gathered by a crowd of fans while he cried,
"Flowers are fine, darn it, but even a national heroine needs air."
There was applause, too, on the evening Jamila Singer and family was invited to President House to sing for the commander of Pepper Potts. Ignoring reports in foreign magazines about embezzled money and Swiss bank accounts, we scrubbed ourselves until we shone. A family in the towel business is obliged to be spotlessly clean. Uncle Puffs gave his gold teeth an extra careful polish, and in a large hall dominated by garlanded portraits of Muhammad Ali Jinnah, the founder of Pakistan, the Qaid-e-Azam, and of his assassinated friend and successor, Liaquat Ali, a perforated sheet was held up and my sister sang. Jamila's voice fell silent at last. The voice of gold braid succeeded her brocade-bordered song.
"Jamila, daughter," we heard, "your voice will be a sword for purity. It will be a weapon with which we shall cleanse men's souls."
President Ayub was, by his own admission, a simple soldier. He instilled in my sister the simple, soldierly virtues of faith in leaders and trust in God. And she, "The president's will is the voice of my heart." Through the hole in a perforated sheet, Jamila Singer dedicated herself to patriotism. And the Divan-e-Khas, the hall of this private audience, rang with applause. Polite now, not the wild wah-wahing of the Bambino crowd, but the regimented approbation of braided gongs and pips, and the delighted clapping of weepy parents.
"I say," Uncle Puffs whispered, "darn fine, eh?"
What I could smell, Jamila could sing. Truth, beauty, happiness, pain. Each had its separate fragrance, and could be distinguished by my nose. Each, in Jamila's performances, could find its ideal voice. My nose, her voice, they were exactly complementary gifts. But they were growing apart. While Jamila sang patriotic songs, my nose seemed to prefer to linger on the uglier smells which invaded it. The bitterness of Aunt Alia, the hard, unchanging stink of my fellow students' closed minds, so that while she rose into the clouds, I fell into the gutter. Looking back, however, I think I was already in love with her, long before I was told. Is there proof of Salim's unspeakable sister love? There is. Jamila Singer had one passion in common with the vanished brass monkey. She loved bread. Chapatis, parathas, tandoori naans, yes, but... Well then, was yeast preferred? It was. My sister, despite patriotism, hankered constantly after leavened bread. And in all Karachi, what was the only source of quality yeasty loaves? Not a baker's. The best bread in the city was handed out through a hatch in an otherwise blind wall every Thursday morning by the Sisters of the Hidden Order of Santa Ignatia. Each week on my Lambretta scooter, I brought my sister the warm, fresh loaves of nuns. Despite long snaking queues, making light of the overspiced, hot, dung-laden odour of the narrow streets around the nunnery, ignoring all other calls upon my time, I fetched the bread. Criticism was entirely absent from my heart. Never once did I ask my sister whether this last relic of her old flirtation with Christianity might not look rather bad in her new role of bulbul of the faith. Is it possible to trace the origins of unnatural love? Did Salim, who had yearned after a place in the centre of history, become besotted with what he saw in his sister of his own hopes for life? Did much mutilated no longer snotnose, as broken a member of the Midnight Children's Conference, as the knife-scarred beggar girl Sundari, fall in love with the new wholeness of his sibling? Once the Mubarak, the Blessed One, did I adore in my sister the fulfilment of my most private dreams? I shall say only that I was unaware of what had happened to me until, with a scooter between my 16-year-old thighs, I began to follow the spores of whores. While Alia smouldered during the early days of Amina Brand Towels, amid the apotheosis of Jamila Singer, when a split-level house rising by command of an umbilical cord was still far from complete, in the time of the late flowering love of my parents, surrounded by the somehow barren certitudes of the land of the pure, Salim Sinai came to terms with himself. I will not say he was not sad, refusing to censor my past. I admit he was as sullen, often as uncooperative, certainly as spotty as most boys of his age. His dreams, denied the children of midnight, became filled with nostalgia to the point of nausea, so that he often woke up gagging with the heavy musk of regret overpowering his senses. There were nightmares of numbers marching, 1, 2, 3, and of a tightening, throttling pair of prehensile knees. But there was a new gift, and a Lambretta scooter, and, though still unconscious, a humble, submissive love of his sister. Jerking my narrator's eyes away from the described past, I insist that Salim, then as now, succeeded in turning his attention towards the as-yet undescribed future, escaping, whenever possible, from a residence in which the acrid fumes of his aunt's envy made life unbearable, and also from a college filled with other equally dislikable smells. I mounted my motorized steed and explored the olfactory avenues of my new city. And after we heard of my grandfather's death in Kashmir, I became even more determined to drown the past in the thick, bubbling scent stew of the present. Oh, dizzying early days before categorization. Formlessly, before I began to shape them, the fragrances poured into me. The mournful, decaying fumes of animal feces in the gardens of the Frere Road Museum. The pustular body odors of young men in loose pajamas holding hands in Sada evenings. The knife sharpness of expectorated betel nut and the bittersweet commingling of betel and opium. Rocket pans were sniffed out in the hawker-crowded alleys between Elphinstone Street and Victoria Road. Camel smells, car smells, the gnat-like irritation of motor rickshaw fumes, the aroma of contraband cigarettes and black money. The competitive effluvia of the city's bus drivers and the simple sweat of their sardine-crowded passengers. One bus driver in those days was so incensed at being overtaken by his rival from another company, the nauseating odour of defeat poured from his glands, that he took his bus round to his opponent's house at night, hooted until the poor fellow emerged, and ran him down beneath wheels reeking, like my aunt, of revenge. Mosques poured over me the itter of devotion. I could smell the orotund emissions of power sent out by flag-waving army motors. In the very hoardings of the cinemas, I could discern the cheap, tawdry perfumes of imported spaghetti westerns and the most violent martial arts films ever made. I was, for a time, like a drugged person, my head reeling beneath the complexities of smell. But then my overpowering desire for form asserted itself, and I survived. Indo-Pakistani relations deteriorated. The borders were closed, so that we could not go to Agra to mourn my grandfather. Reverend Mother's emigration to Pakistan was also somewhat delayed. In the meantime, Salim was working towards a general theory of smell. Classification procedures had begun. I saw this scientific approach as my own personal obeisance to the spirit of my grandfather. To begin with, I perfected my skill at distinguishing, until I could tell apart, the infinite varieties of betel nut, and, with my eyes shut, the 12 different available brands of fizzy drink. Long before the American commentator Herbert Feldman came to Karachi to deplore the existence of a dozen aerated waters in a city which had only 3 suppliers of bottled milk, I could sit blindfolded and tell Pakola from Hoffman's Mission, Citra-Cola from Fanta. Feldman saw these drinks as a manifestation of capitalist imperialism. I, sniffing out which was Canada Dry and which 7-Up, unerringly separating Pepsi from Coke, was more interested in passing their subtle olfactory test. Double Cola and Cola Cola, Perry Cola and Bubble Up were blindly identified and named. Only when I was sure of my mastery of physical sense did I move on to those other aromas, which only I could smell. The perfumes of emotions, and all the 1001 drives which make us human. Love and death, greed and humility, have and have not, were labelled and placed in neat compartments of my mind. Early attempts at ordering. I tried to classify smells by colour. Boiling underwear and the printer's ink of the Daily Jang shared a quality of blueness, while old teak and fresh farts were both dark brown. Motor cars and graveyards I jointly classified as grey. There was, too, classification by weight. Flyweight smells, paper. Bantam odours, soap fresh bodies, grass. Welterweights, perspiration, queen of the night. Shai korma and bicycle oil were light heavyweight in my system, while anger, patchouli, treachery and dung were among the heavyweight stinks of the earth. And I had a geometric system also, the roundness of joy and the angularity of ambition. I had elliptical smells, and also ovals and squares. A lexicographer of the nose. I travel Bunda Road and the PECHS. A lepidopterist, I snared whiffs like butterflies in the net of my nasal hairs. Oh, wondrous voyages before the birth of philosophy, because soon I understood that my work must, if it was to have any value, acquire a moral dimension, that the only important divisions were the infinitely subtle gradations of good and evil smells. Having realized the crucial nature of morality, having sniffed out that smells could be sacred or profane, I invented, in the isolation of my scooter trips, the science of nasal ethics. Sacred. Purdah veils, halal meat, muezzin's towers, prayer mats. Profane. Western records, pig meat, alcohol. I understood now why mullahs, sacred, refused to enter aeroplanes, profane, on the night before Id-ul-Fitr, not even willing to enter vehicles whose secret odour was the antithesis of godliness in order to make sure of seeing the new moon. I learned the olfactory incompatibility of Islam and socialism, and the inalienable opposition existing between the aftershave of Sind Club members and the poverty reek of the street-sleeping beggars at the club gates. More and more, however, I became convinced of an ugly truth, namely that the sacred or good held little interest for me, even when such aroma surrounded my sister as she sang, while the pungency of the gutter seemed to possess a fatally irresistible attraction. Besides, I was 16. Things were stirring beneath my belt, behind my duck-white pants. And no city which locks women away is ever short of whores. While Jamila sang of holiness and love of country, I explored profanity and lust. I had money to burn. My father had become generous as well as loving. At the eternally unfinished Jinnah Mausoleum, I picked up the women of the street. Other youths came here to seduce American girls away, taking them off to hotel rooms or swimming pools. I preferred to retain my independence and pay. And eventually I nosed out the whore of whores, whose gifts were a mirror of my own. Her name was Tai Bibi, and she claimed to be 512. But her smell! The richest spoor he, Salim, had ever sniffed. He felt bewitched by something in it, some air of historic majesty. He found himself saying to the toothless creature, "I don't care about your age. The smell's the thing." "My God," Padma interrupts, "such a thing! How could you?" Though she never hinted at any connection with a Kashmiri boatman, her name exerted the strongest of pulls. Although she may have been humouring Salim when she said, "Boy, I am 512. His sense of history was nevertheless aroused. "Think of me what you like. I spent one hot, humid afternoon in a tenement room containing a flea-ridden mattress and a naked light bulb and the oldest whore in the world." What finally made Tai Bibi irresistible? What gift of control did she possess which put other whores to shame? What maddened the newly sensitized nostrils of our Salim? "Padma, my ancient prostitute possessed a mastery over her gland so total that she could alter her bodily odours to match those of anyone on earth. Ekrins and apocrins obeyed the instructions of her antiquated will, and although she said, 'Don't expect me to do it standing up, you couldn't pay enough for that,' her gifts of perfume were more than he could bear." "Chi-chi!" Padma covers her ears. "My God, such a dirty, filthy man I never knew." So, there he was, this peculiar, hideous youth, with an old hag who said, "I won't stand up, my corns." And then noticed that the mention of corn seemed to arouse him. Whispering the secret of her ekrine and apocrine facility, she asked if he'd like her to imitate anyone's smells. He could describe, and she could try. And by trial and error, they could. And at first he jerked away. "No, no, no." But she coaxed him, in her voice like crumpled paper. Until, because he was alone, out of the world and out of all time, alone with this impossible, mythological old harridan, he began to describe odours with all the perspicacity of his miraculous nose, and Tai Bibi began to imitate his descriptions, leaving him aghast, as by trial and error she succeeded in reproducing the body odours of his mother, his aunts. "Oh-ho, you like that, do you, little Shabzada? Go on, stick your nose as close as you like. You're a funny fellow for sure." Until suddenly, by accident, yes, I swear, I didn't make her do it, suddenly, during trial and error, the most unspeakable fragrance on earth wafts out of the cracked, wrinkled, leather ancient body. And now he can't hide what she sees. "Oh-ho, little Shahibzada, what have I hit on now? You don't have to tell. Who is she? But this one is the one for sure." And Salim, "Shut up, shut up!" But Tai Bibi, with the relentlessness of her cackling antiquity, presses on. "Oh-ha, yes, certainly, ya lady love, little Shahibzada. Who? Your cousin, maybe? Your sister? Salim's hand is tightening into a fist. The right hand, despite mutilated finger, contemplates violence. And now Tai Bibi. My God! Yes! Your sister! Go on, hit me. You can't hide what's sitting there in the middle of your forehead. And Salim, gathering up his clothes, struggling into trousers, shut up, old hag, while she, yes, go, go, but if you don't pay me, I'll, you see what I don't do. And now rupees flying across the room, floating down around 512-year-old courtesan. Take, take, only shut your hideous face, while she, careful, my princeling, you're not so handsome yourself, dressed now and rushing from the tenement, Lambretta scooter waiting, but urchins have urinated on the seat. He is driving away as fast as he can go, but the truth is going with him. And now Tai Bibi, leaning out of a window, shouts,
Hey! Benchard! Hey! Little sister sleeper! Where are you running? What's true is true is true!
You may legitimately ask, did it happen in just this? And surely she couldn't have been 500 and... But I swore to confess everything, and I insist that I learned the unspeakable secret of my love for Jamila Singha from the mouth and scent glands of that most exceptional of whores.
Our Mrs. Braganza is right,
Padma is scolding me.
She says there is nothing but dirt in the heads of the men's.
I ignore her. Mrs. Braganza and her sister, Mrs. Fernandez, will be dealt with in due course. For the moment, the latter must be content with the factory accounts while the former looks after my son. And while I, to recapture the rapt attention of my revolted Padma Bibi, recount a fairy tale. Once upon a time, in the far northern princedom of Kif, there lived a prince who had two beautiful daughters, a son of equally remarkable good looks, a brand new Rolls-Royce motor car, and excellent political contacts. This prince, or Nawab, believed passionately in progress, which was why he had arranged the engagement of his elder daughter to the son of the prosperous and well-known General Zulfikar. For his younger daughter, he had high hopes of a match with the son of the president himself. As for his motor car, the first ever seen in his mountain-ringed valley, he loved it almost as much as his children. It grieved him that his subjects, who had become used to using the roads of Kif for purposes of social intercourse, quarrels and games of hit the spittoon, refused to get out of its way. He issued a proclamation explaining that the car represented the future and must be allowed to pass. The people ignored the notice, although it was pasted to shop fronts and walls and even, it is said, to the sides of cows. The second notice was more peremptory, ordering the citizenry to clear the highways when they heard the horn of the car. The Kiffies, however, continued to smoke and spit and argue in the streets. The third notice, which was adorned with a gory drawing, said that the car would henceforth run down anybody who failed to obey its horn. The Kiffies added new, more scandalous pictures to the one on the poster, and then the Nawab, who was a good man, but not one of infinite patience, actually did as he threatened. When the famous singer Jamila arrived with her family and impresario to sing at her cousin's engagement ceremony, the car drove her without trouble from border to palace, and the Nawab said proudly,
No trouble, the car is respected now. Progress has occurred.
The Nawab's son, Mutasim, who had travelled abroad and wore his hair in something called a beetle cut, was a source of worry to his father, because although he was so good-looking that whenever he travelled around Kif, girls with silver-nosed jewellery fainted in the heat of his beauty, he seemed to take no interest in such matters, being content with his polo ponies and the guitar on which he picked out strange Western songs.
He wore bush shirts on which musical notation and foreign street signs jostled against the half-clad bodies of pink-skinned girls. But when Jamila Singer, concealed within a gold-brocaded burqa, arrived at the palace, Mutasim the Handsome, who, owing to his foreign travels, had never heard the rumours of her disfigurement, became obsessed with the idea of seeing her face. He fell head over heels with the glimpses of her demure eyes he saw through her perforated sheet. In those days, the President of Pakistan had decreed an election. It was to take place on the day after the engagement ceremony, under a form of suffrage called basic democracy. The 100 million people of Pakistan had been divided up into 120,000 approximately equal parts, and each part was represented by one basic democrat. The electoral college of 120,000 BDs were to elect the president. In Kif, the 420 basic democrats included mullahs, road sweepers, the Nawab's chauffeur, numerous men who sharecropped hashish on the Nawab's estate, and other loyal citizens. The Nawab had invited all of these to his daughter's hennaing ceremony. He had, however, also been obliged to invite two rail budmashes, the returning officers of the combined opposition party. These budmashes quarrel constantly amongst themselves, but the Nawab was courteous and welcoming.
"Tonight you are my honoured friends," he told them, "and tomorrow is another day."
The Badmashes ate and drank as if they had never seen food before, but everybody, even Mutasim the Handsome, whose patience was shorter than his father's, was told to treat them well. The combined opposition party, you will not be surprised to hear, was a collection of rogues and scoundrels of the first water, united only in their determination to unseat the president and returned to the bad old days in which civilians, and not soldiers, lined their pockets from the public exchequer. But for some reason they had acquired a formidable leader. This was Mistress Fatima Jinnah, the sister of the founder of the nation, a woman of such desiccated antiquity that the Nawab suspected she had died long ago and been stuffed by a master taxidermist, a notion supported by his son, who had seen a movie called El Cid, in which a dead man led an army into battle. But there she was, nevertheless, goaded into electioneering by the president's failure to complete the marbling of her brother's mausoleum. A terrible foe, above slander and suspicion. It was even said that her opposition to the president had shaken the people's faith in him. Was he not, after all, the reincarnation of the great Islamic heroes of yesteryear, of Muhammad bin Samghuri, of Iltutmish and the Mughals? Even in Kif itself, the Nawab had noticed COP stickers appearing in curious places. Someone had even had the cheek to affix one to the boot of the rolls. "Bad days," the Nawab told his son. Mutasim replied, "That's what elections get you. Latrine cleaners and cheap tailors must vote to elect a ruler." But today was a day for happiness. In the Zenana chambers, women were patterning the Nawab's daughter's hands and feet with delicate traceries of henna. Soon, General Zulfikar and his son Zafar would arrive. The rulers of Kif put the election out of their heads, refusing to think of the crumbling figure of Fatima Jinnah. The Madar-i-Millat, or Mother of the Nation, who had so callously chosen to confuse her children's choosing. In the quarters of Jamila Singer's party too, happiness reigned supreme. Her father, a towel manufacturer who could not seem to relinquish the soft hand of his wife, cried, "You see whose daughter is performing here? Is it a Haroon girl? A Valaika woman? Is it a Dawood or Segal wench? Like hell!" But his son, Salim, an unfortunate fellow with a face like a cartoon, seemed to be gripped by some deep malaise. Perhaps, overwhelmed by his presence at the scene of great historical events, he glanced towards his gifted sister with something in his eyes which looked like shame. That afternoon, Mutasim the Handsome took Jamila's brother Salim to one side and tried hard to make friends. He showed Salim the peacocks imported from Rajasthan before partition, and the Nawab's precious collection of books of spells, from which he extracted such talismans and incantations as would help him rule with sagacity. And while Mutasim, who was not the most intelligent or cautious of youths, was escorting Salim around the polo field, he confessed that he had written out a love charm on a piece of parchment in the hope of pressing it against the hand of the famous Jamila singer and making her fall in love. At this point, Salim acquired the air of a bad-tempered dog and tried to turn away, but Mutasim now begged to know what Jamila singer really looked like. Salim, however, kept his silence until Mutasim, in the grip of a wild obsession, asked to be brought close enough to Jamila to press his charm against her hand. Now Salim, whose sly look did not register on love-struck Mutasim, said, "Give me the parchment." And Mutasim, who, though expert in the geography of European cities, was innocent in things magical, yielded his charm to Salim, thinking it would still work on his behalf, even if applied by another. Evening approached at the palace. The convoy of cars bringing General and Begum Zulfikar, their son Zafar and friends, approached too. But now the wind changed and began to blow from the north, a cold wind, and also an intoxicating one, because in the north of Kif were the best hashish fields in the land, and at this time of year the female plants were ripe and in heat. The air was filled with the perfume of the heady lust of the plants, and all who breathed it became doped to some extent. The vacuous beatitude of the plants affected the drivers in the convoy, which only reached the palace by great good fortune, having overturned a number of street-side barber stalls and invaded at least one tea-shop, leaving the kifs wondering whether the new horseless carriages, having stolen the streets, were now going to capture their homes as well. The wind from the north entered the enormous and highly sensitive nose of Salim, Jamila's brother, and made him so drowsy that he fell asleep in his room, so that he missed the events of an evening, during which he afterwards learned the hashishin wind had transformed the behaviour of the guests at the engagement ceremony, making them giggle convulsively and gaze provocatively at one another through heavy-lidded eyes. Braided generals sat splay-legged on gilded chairs and dreamed of paradise. The Mendi ceremony took place amid a sleepy contentment so profound that nobody noticed when the bridegroom relaxed so completely that he wet his pants, and even the quarrelling budmashes from the COP linked arms and sang a folk song. And when Mutasim the Handsome, possessed by the lustiness of hashish plants, attempted to plunge behind the great gold and silken sheet with its single hole, Major Aladdin Latif restrained him with beatific good humour, preventing him from seeing Jamila Singer's face without even bloodying his nose. The evening ended when all the guests fell asleep at their tables, but Jamila Singer was escorted to her rooms by a sleepily beaming Latif. At midnight, Salim awoke to find that he still clutched the magical parchment of Mutasim the Handsome in his right hand, and since the wind from the north was still blowing gently through his room, he made up his mind to creep in chappals and dressing gown through the darkened passages of the lovely palace, past all the accumulated debris of a decaying world, rusting suits of armour and ancient tapestries which provided centuries of food for the palace's 1 billion moths, giant mahasir trouts swimming in glass seas, and a profusion of hunting trophies, including a tarnished golden tita bird on a teak plinth, which commemorated the day on which an earlier Nawab, in the company of Lord Curzon and party, had shot 111,111 titars in a single day. He crept past the statues of dead birds into the zenana chambers,
where the women of the palace slept, and then, sniffing the air, he selected one door, turned the handle and went inside. There was a giant bed, with a floating mosquito net caught in a stream of colourless light from the maddening midnight moon. Selim moved towards it and then stopped, because he had seen at the window the figure of a man trying to climb into the room. Mutasim the Handsome, made shameless by his infatuation and the Hashishin wind, had resolved to look at Jamila's face, no matter what the cost. And Selim, invisible in the shadows of the room, cried out, "Hands up, or I shoot!" Selim was bluffing, but Mutasim, whose hands were on the windowsill, supporting his full weight, did not know that, and was placed in a quandary, to hang on and be shot, or let go and fall. He attempted to argue back. "You shouldn't be here yourself," he said. "I'll tell Amina Begum." He had recognized the voice of his oppressor, but Selim pointed out the weakness of his position, and Mutasim pleading, "Okay, only don't fire," was permitted to descend the way he'd come. After that day, Mutasim persuaded his father to make a formal proposal of marriage to Jamila's parents, but she, who had been born and raised without love, retained her old hatred of all who claimed to love her, and turned him down. He left Kif and came to Karachi, but she would not entertain his importunate proposals, and eventually he joined the army and became a martyr in the War of 1965. The tragedy of Mutasim the Handsome, however, is only a subplot in our story, because now Selim and his sister were alone, and she, awakened by the exchange between the two youths, asked, "Selim, what is happening?" Selim approached his sister's bed, his hands sought hers, and parchment was pressed against skin. Only now did Selim, his tongue loosened by the moon and the lust-drenched breeze, abandon all notions of purity and confess his own love to his open-mouthed sister. There was a silence. Then she cried, "Oh, no, how can you?" But the magic of the parchment was doing battle with the strength of her hatred of love. So although her body grew stiff and jerky as a wrestler's, she listened to him explaining that there was no sin. He had worked it all out, and after all, they were not truly brother and sister. The blood in his veins was not the blood in hers. In the breeze of that insane night, he attempted to undo all the knots which not even Mary Pereira's confession had succeeded in untying. But even as he spoke, he could hear his words sounding hollow and realize that although what he was saying was the literal truth, there were other truths which had become more important because they had been sanctified by time. And although there was no need for shame or horror, he saw both emotions on her forehead. He smelt them on her skin. And what was worse, he could feel and smell them in and upon himself. So, in the end, not even the magic parchment of Mutasim the Handsome was powerful enough to bring Selim Sanai and Jamila Singer together. He left her room with bowed head, followed by her dear startled eyes, and in time the effects of the spell faded altogether, and she took a dreadful revenge. As he left the room, the corridors of the palace were suddenly filled with the shriek of a newly affianced princess, who had awoken from a dream of her wedding night in which her marital bed had suddenly and unaccountably become awash in rancid yellow liquid. Afterwards she made inquiries, and when she learned the prophetic truth of her dream, resolved never to reach puberty while Zafar was alive, so that she could stay in her palatial bedroom and avoid the foul-smelling horror of his weakness. The next morning, the two Badmashes of the combined opposition party awoke to find themselves back in their own beds, but when they had dressed, they opened the door of their chamber to find two of the biggest soldiers in Pakistan outside it, standing peacefully with crossed rifles, barring the exit. The Badmashes shouted and wheedled, but the soldiers stayed in position until the polls were closed. Then they quietly disappeared.
The Badmashes sought out the Nawab, finding him in his exceptional rose garden. They waved their arms and raised their voices. Travesty of justice was mentioned, and electoral jiggery-pokery, also chicanery. But the Nawab showed them 30 new varieties of Kiffy Rose crossbred by himself. They ranted on, death of democracy, autocratic tyranny, until he smiled gently, and said, "My friends, yesterday my daughter was betrothed to Zafar Zulfikar. Soon, I hope, my other girl will wed our president's own dear son. Think, then, what dishonour for me, what scandal on my name, if even one vote were cast in Kif against my future relative. Friends, I am a man to whom honour is of concern, so stay in my house. Eat, drink, only do not ask for what I cannot give." And we all lived happily, at any rate, even without the traditional last-sentence fiction of fairy tales. My story does indeed end in fantasy, because when basic Democrats had done their duty, the newspapers, Jang, Dawn, Pakistan Times, announced a crushing victory for the President's Muslim League over the Madhya-e Millat's combined opposition party, thus proving to me that I have been only the humblest of jugglers with facts, and that, in a country where the truth is what it is instructed to be, reality quite literally ceases to exist, so that everything becomes possible, except what we are told is the case. And maybe this was the difference between my Indian childhood and Pakistani adolescence, that in the first I was beset by an infinity of alternative realities, while in the second I was adrift, disorientated amid an equally infinite number of falsenesses, unrealities, and lies. A little bird whispers in my ear, "Be fair. Nobody, no country has a monopoly of untruth." I accept the criticism. I know. And years later, the widow knew, and Jamila, for whom what had been sanctified as truth by time, by habit, by a grandmother's pronouncement, by lack of imagination, by a father's acquiescence, proved more believable than what she knew to be so. How Salim achieved purity. What is waiting to be told? The return of TikTok. But now time is counting down to an end, not a birth. There is, too, a weariness to be mentioned, a general fatigue so profound that the end, when it comes, will be the only solution. Because human beings, like nations and fictional characters, can simply run out of steam. And then there's nothing for it but to finish with them. How a piece fell out of the moon and Salim achieved purity. The clock is ticking now. And because all countdowns require a zero, let me state that the end came on September 22, 1965, and that the precise instant of the arrival at zero was, inevitably, the stroke of midnight. Although the old grandfather clock in my Aunt Alia's house, which kept accurate time but always chimed 2 minutes late, never had a chance to strike. My grandmother, Nazim Aziz, arrived in Pakistan in mid-1964, leaving behind an India in which Nehru's death had precipitated a bitter power struggle. Morarji Desai, the finance minister, and Jagjivan Ram, most powerful of the untouchables, united in their determination to prevent the establishment of a Nehru dynasty. So Indira Gandhi was denied the leadership. The new prime minister was Lal Bahadur Shastri, another member of that generation of politicians who seemed to have been pickled in immortality. In the case of Shastri, however, this was only Maya, illusion. Nehru and Shastri have both fully proved their mortality. But there are still plenty of others left.